Does our galaxy, the Milky Way, have two spiral arms or four? It turns out that's a matter of debate among scientists. This hour, we'll find out why. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A chance for us to chat about a handful of items in the news. Later in the hour, Charles Figura, professor of physics and astronomy at Wartburg College in Waverly, he'll tell us about the work he's done to help resolve the debate over the shape of our galaxy. Before that, a look ahead at the new legislative session with Joyce Russell, a winter flu season update from Patricia Quinlisk, and an odd story of political intrigue in Marion. Our Friday News Buzz starts right after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's a Friday News Buzz edition of our program, a time for us to take a handful of topics in the news and to cover them with some quick conversations through the hour. So if you don't like what you're hearing at any given time during the hour, wait 5 minutes, and it will change. Coming up later in the hour, the shape of our galaxy. We'll hear from a professor of physics about the shape of our galaxy, why it's even debated. Does it have two arms or four arms, or does it even matter? Also, an update on the winter flu season and a story of amusing political intrigue in Marion, Iowa. But first, state lawmakers returned to the Capitol earlier this week. Lots going on in the Capitol this week. Not only the legislators returning, we heard Governor Branstad giving his condition of the state address, and he announced his bid for re-election. Joining us now, Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell, to talk a little bit about how the Capitol is gearing up for this session. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
Last year's session of part of the General Assembly was touted as one of the most successful General Assemblies ever. Remind us what got accomplished.
Well, three big items: education reform, a multi-million-dollar plan to rework how teachers are paid, the property tax cut. Mostly a property tax cut, but other tax changes. And then the health care bill that passed, which is Iowa's response to the the Affordable Care Act.
So it was touted as one of the most successful ever, right?
Well, yeah, that's what they're saying. And, you know, it's a two-year General Assembly. This is the second year of the two-year General Assembly. Mm-hmm. And even though they're not planning anything big this year, on the strength of what they did last year, some people are saying this is the most productive session ever. Mm-hmm. And really, that tax cut bill is going to have really long-term implications. And the education reform bill, too, if in fact in these outlying years, if they fund it the way they've promised to.
Mm-hmm. So this is the second year of their two-year General Assembly, very productive in the first year of that. Why would they not be as productive in this part? Are they panting? They're just exhausted from last year.
A little bit. And what they'll say when you ask them questions like that is, well, we really need to keep an eye on what passed last year and make sure that it's implemented, and that's totally legitimate. But then the other underlying thing here is that this is an election year. People really want to get home to campaign for re-election. As you know, the second year of the General Assembly is always shorter. It's 100 days instead of 110. And they've moved up the deadlines to get things going and get out of there faster, and that's to get home and campaign.
Joyce, I understand from your reporting that the surplus nice problem to have. An expected budget surplus is something that will be battled over.
Well, oh yes, definitely, because the governor has projected the budget out for 5 years, and over those 5 years, he wants to implement education reform and the property tax cuts, and that will gradually chip away at that surplus until it's gone. Democrats have implied that they're going to be more willing to spend more of that surplus now for some of their initiatives.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we can predict the GOP response to that is what, from people like Republican House Speaker Craig Paulson?
Oh, his response would be, if we've got a surplus, that means we've collected too many taxes and we should give it back.
Mm-hmm. What other legislation may be passed this year that you see on the horizon?
Well, it looks like the governor's really entire agenda is going to get passed. The highlights of that are those which you've been hearing about, that his veterans initiative, a skilled workforce initiative, a broadband initiative. Both parties say no reason why we can't pass those. And then his anti-bullying bill, which was – we haven't seen it yet, but that one is likely going to be harder to reach consensus on. They tried last year to pass an anti-bullying bill and just – couldn't reach consensus on it. School administrators weighing in big time on this and concerned about what kind of liability that will create for them. So I'm really not sure whether they're going to be able to pull that off this year. They're going to get an earlier start on it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Do we know how Iowa measures up with anti-bullying legislation and laws when we compare ourselves to other states?
I know a number of states have passed initiatives, and it is kind of a trend.
Mm-hmm. What about issues that are being introduced that you don't think have much chance of making it through?
Well, some of the high-profile things like the minimum wage, probably not. Medical marijuana that's being floated again this year in the current climate of marijuana legalization, almost certainly not. And then we have the perennial guesses about whether the gas tax is going to be raised. Again, probably not, although a bill was introduced this week to raise the gas tax by 10 cents gradually over the next 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, the governor on that point is not completely close to the idea of a gas tax, is he?
Correct. But on the other hand, he's not getting out in front of it either.
Mm, okay. So we had Governor Branstad's condition of the state speech earlier this week. What were the major points that he wanted to make?
Well, you know, he laid out his agenda, some of the items we've been talking about. He emphasized Iowa's improving economy and the health of the state budget. Some were commenting that it came across like a campaign speech, and I guess that's fair. One of the first points he made was that Iowans managed to help reverse the International Olympics Committee decision on wrestling. That was the first of many applause lines, and some found that kind of an odd thing to stress right off the bat.
And then the day after that, he announced his bid for re-election. This would be a sixth term, not all consecutive terms. He's, in his fifth term now. And he is, if I'm not mistaken, Joyce, he is the longest-serving governor in the United States.
I think that's right.
Yeah. According to the research that I did, he's been there very long, since 1982 was he first elected, I believe.
Yeah, and then, of course, they had a little time out for Democrats to run things for a while there.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, with having served so long, if the feeling there at the State House, people covering his condition of the state speech, was that perhaps it wasn't quite as bold as one might expect from a governor who really, at this point, has no serious competition for re-election and has such a history, such a legacy with Iowans.
Well, that's exactly what Democrat Jack Hatch said, was that it was a timid agenda, given, you know, the resources that we have and so on. So, you know, the stage is set for Senator Hatch. Right now it looks like the likely Democratic nominee. He'll have the session to continue to make his points and his campaign mm-hmm. points.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard that really when the governor did give his condition of the state speech, one of the very few people who criticized anything that the governor said in that speech was Jack Hatch. And he talked about jobs, the jobs that the governor said he would create. And what's the controversy there?
Oh, well, you know, the governor, when he ran for office, made several very specific promises. One was to create 200,000 new jobs, and another was to increase household income by 25%. And the governor, for some time now, has been putting out the number that he's created 130,000 jobs. But critics of that say, well, that doesn't count the jobs that were lost over that period of time. So they're quibbling with that way of counting things. But then the other thing that came out this week was, you know, what was missing from his speech. He didn't say anything about increasing household income. And Democrats said, you know, that's important too, that Democrats want to raise the minimum wage. And so they're sort of calling the governor to task for not even mentioning increasing household income when they say increasing the minimum wage would help accomplish that.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we started off, you listed the accomplishments of the first year of the two-year General Assembly, the big ones: education, property taxes, health care. Now, Senate Majority Leader Mike Gronstall, Democrat, said on this program that job number one is to make sure to follow up with school funding after last year's education reform. Do you see others in agreement across parties?
Yeah, I mean, following through with last year's bill, that's really on everyone's lips these days. But there's some potential controversy there. The governor put $44 million in his budget for that, for the teacher pay initiative. Democrats are already saying that's less than what was talked about when the education reform was passed last year. And then the other really major point of contention is last year they passed what they call allowable growth. Now they're calling it supplemental pay. How much more state money school districts around the state will get. They passed that for the school year that's going on right now. By state law, they're supposed to pass it for the following year as well. And the governor didn't put anything in his budget for that. Mm-hmm. So that's they're going to have some discussions about that, I'm sure.
And Joyce, our researcher, producer, Emily Woodbury, just was researching during our conversation here. And as we end here, we can definitely say that Governor Terry Branstad is the longest serving governor in U.S. history. So there.
Okay. And, you know, and actually, you know, his time at the State House goes back even further. He was first elected to the Iowa legislature in 1973.
What a legacy. Thank you, Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell, for joining us.
Okay. Thank you.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. NewsBuzz on Fridays, a quick chance to touch on a handful of news stories with quick conversation, stories that we didn't get to earlier this week in our talk shows. In the health corner, flu is making itself felt nationally and across the state during this winter flu season. In fact, the first flu-related death was reported this week in Iowa. That, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health, the department has also been notified of several probable adult deaths related to influenza. We're joined now by Patricia Quinlisk, medical director at the Iowa Department of Public Health. Hi, Patricia.
Hi.
The death that was reported, a flu death reported, it was a child.
It was a child. We do ask that any children who die of flu-related illness be reported to us immediately, and unfortunately we had the death of an otherwise healthy child reported to us.
Mm-hmm. In cases of flu, what actually leads to death or can lead to death?
Well, it depends. Of course, the people at highest risk of getting seriously ill and even dying are people who already have health problems. For example, people who have lung problems, asthma, COPD, or heart problems, diabetes, things like that are all things that put you at risk of getting seriously ill if you do get the flu. But the thing that people forget is even healthy people can get the flu, get seriously ill, and as this unfortunate death shows us, even healthy children can die of the flu.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about what you say in the department are probable deaths related to influenza among adults.
Well, adults, we don't ask the people pick up the phone and report to us immediately. Usually with those, they get on a death certificate, and we pull the information off a little bit later off of a death certificate. And to be honest, usually with adults, it's a little bit more complicated because often what happens with the flu is that, you know, grandma gets the flu, then unfortunately gets a bacterial pneumonia on top of the flu, ends up in a hospital, and dies. So flu contributes to the death, but grandma may have also had, you know, cardiac disease and diabetes. And so, unfortunately, flu contributes to the death but may not be the only thing that's involved in that death. So counting adult deaths gets a little bit more complicated than something like this unfortunate child's death who basically only had the flu.
Mm-hmm. Share with us some of the statistics that you're seeing as we are well into the flu season here in the state.
Well, we track a bunch of things. People always ask, how many cases have we had? And we don't count up individual cases because we estimate there are probably tens of thousands, if not sometimes hundreds of thousands, of people getting ill with the flu each year. So we don't need to know about every single case. What we do is we have sentinel clinics and sentinel hospitals. In other words, out of the 120-some hospitals in Iowa, we have 20 hospitals tell us every week about how many people have been hospitalized at those hospitals or have died at those hospitals. So we know that the numbers of people being hospitalized is steadily going up. And one of the interesting things we're seeing this year about the people being hospitalized is that we're not seeing the people we typically see. In a typical flu season, we would see the babies and the elderly people being hospitalized. This year, we're seeing the children, the young adults, and their parents' age. It's the people between, say, 5 and 45 that are the majority of people being hospitalized. So that's quite unusual. And the reason that's happening is because the strain of flu that we're seeing this year, it's named H1N1, that strain is the strain that, for reasons we don't fully understand, really likes to hit children and young adults very hard.
Mm-hmm. So this is a particularly lethal strain of the flu.
Well, all strains of flu can be lethal. This one, though, I think it's surprisingly lethal because it hits the people that we normally think of in our society as being the healthiest, the children, the young adults. But this strain just hits those people very hard. And that's why this year it's particularly important to make sure that those people are vaccinated, that we don't just vaccinate the elderly, that we get those school-age children, college kids, the young adults, all of them go in and get their flu shots also.
Do we know how well we've done here in Iowa in terms of flu vaccination?
Well, we're watching it this year, and we do know that this year we've done better. We've gotten more people vaccinated than we have last year or the year before, but not a huge number more.
What does that mean? Do you have a percent?
We do very, very well at getting our elderly vaccinated. We're one of the best states in the country about getting the elderly vaccinated, but unfortunately, we're not very good at getting our children vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Do you have percentages to go along with those?
Well, I don't know about this year because, of course, we're still in the middle of it. But, for example, with our elderly, usually we're somewhere around 85, maybe even 90% of our elderly get vaccinated each year. In our children, we're probably down at about only 40%, maybe at the most 50% of our children being vaccinated. And what that means is there's a lot of vulnerable children out there. But what it also means is those children can get sick, take it into school, and spread it around the school. And anybody who's got school-aged children know that that's a great place to spread around these diseases.
Right, and we have most schools back in session now for a few days. So you would expect an uptick with all those kids going back to school, trading germs after coming back from sometimes far-flung places.
That's right. We do often, right after the holidays, start seeing the number of outbreaks in schools just really starting to pick up. And by, say, the end of January and February, we just see lots and lots of outbreaks going on in schools.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's why right now, if you go in and get your kid or your young adult and your family or you vaccinated, you will be protected for those times when it's really going to start to cause widespread disease here in Iowa. So don't put it off any longer. Go get your flu shot now.
Right. And we toss around the word flu, and sometimes people refer to the flu even though they might not have it. I find there's confusion, perhaps you do too, between stomach flu, and a really bad cold, right?
Right, and people do get confused because they'll often say, well, I got the flu shot, but then I got the stomach flu, so it didn't work. Well, the stomach flu is actually caused by a totally different virus called norovirus, and that one, of course, the flu vaccine doesn't give you coverage for, and in fact, there is no vaccine for that. That's the disease that basically gives you a day or two of bad diarrhea and vomiting, but then after about 2-3 days, you feel better and you're back at school or at work. But it's not the flu. When people have the flu, they have respiratory symptoms. They'll have a cough. They'll have a sore throat, those kind of symptoms. So they can be confused sometimes with a bad cold. But what I tell people usually is if you have a cold, you'll basically have symptoms from the neck up, sore throat, runny nose, maybe itchy, gooey eyes. But your body feels okay. You get the flu, and your body doesn't feel good. You have a fever. You have aches and pains. You have fatigue. You don't feel like eating. You're in bed. That's the flu. That's not a cold.
Okay, so that's a good way to remember it. From the neck up, then it's probably a bad cold. If it's in the entire body that you're feeling all these aches and pains, you probably got the flu. That's something I can remember. What about treatment? How do you treat the flu?
Well, and there is treatment for the flu. People sometimes don't know that. There are antiviral medications that can be given for the flu, and they do work quite well. The problem with them is you have to start taking them right away. After about 24, 48 hours, they just don't work anymore. So if you've been sick for 4 days at home and then go see your doctor, they can't give you antivirals because you've been sick too long and they're just not going to work. You really have to start them right away. But if you're somebody, especially somebody who's got one of those medical conditions like heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, and you think you're coming down with a cold because you got a high fever and you're feeling achy and icky and you think it's the flu, go in or call your healthcare provider right away because they can give you antivirals and it will prevent you from being sick as long and it may prevent you from becoming seriously ill and dying.
And we do have to say this is not something you want to trifle with. I was looking back at the statistics connected with a great flu epidemic nearly 100 years ago in 1918, and I was surprised to remember that that flu killed between 20 and 40 million people worldwide, killed more people than those killed during World War I.
That's right.
Now, is this strain we have this year, H1N1, in any way connected with that strain of the great flu epidemic of 1918?
Well, we don't know is the bottom answer, but certainly we talk about flu pandemics, in other words, epidemics that occur all over the world, and certainly what happened in 1918 was a pandemic. Now, in 2009, if people remember, we had a pandemic in the world also. That was with H1N1, and that's that year that people started getting sick in May, which is not your typical flu season. People got sick all over the place. We even had schools closing here in Iowa. We had children getting very ill. That was that same strain that we're seeing this year in Iowa. It's just that now it's not a pandemic anymore. It's just sort of become the flu strain that we see during our typical flu season.
Mm-hmm. And in closing, just remind us on the most effective way to steer clear of these germs as we go to work and go to school.
Right. Well, the first thing that you need to do for yourself is make sure that you're vaccinated. That gives you personal protection. But the thing that we all need to do to keep ourselves and everybody around us healthy is to make sure that when we cough or sneeze, we do it into our elbow, not into our hand, that we do keep our hands clean. So if we do pick up a germ on a doorknob or something, we're not inoculating ourselves with one of these bad germs. And the last thing, and this is really important, when you are sick, stay home. Don't, go to school or go to work when you got a high temperature and you're coughing because you're just going to spread it to all your coworkers or your fellow students, and they're not going to appreciate it. So stay home. You'll feel better faster, and your friends and everybody will appreciate it.
Medical Director at the Iowa Department of Public Health, Patricia Quinlisk, always great to talk with you, and let's do stay healthy the rest of this winter season.
Sounds good to me. Thanks.
Coming up after a short break, we'll talk with Gazette columnist Todd Dorman. He'll tell us about a very odd hearing before the Marion City Council this week that he attended. It was a hearing that was called because a group challenged Mayor Snooks Buska's residency. They charged that he actually lives in Hiawatha, not Marion. And therefore, the mayor position was open. After that amusing saga of political intrigue, we ask the question, how many spiral arms does our galaxy, the Milky Way, have? Charles Figura, professor of physics at Wartburg College in Waverly, will tell us about his work to help resolve the debate over the shape of our galaxy. Turns out it's quite a challenge finding out the shape of our galaxy from our perspective inside it. Plenty more on NewsBuzz after a short break. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a News Buzz edition of our program on this Friday. And Cedar Rapids Gazette columnist Todd Dorman began one of his columns this week by writing, "The number of public meetings of one type or another I've covered over the years is countless. A guy gets the feeling that he's seen just about everything. Then I spent nearly 4 hours at Tuesday night's quasi-judicial hearing before the Marion City Council. petitioned for by Citizens for a Better Marion, and I realized I was wrong. I hadn't seen everything yet. Todd Dorman joins us now to share this amusing and odd political saga that's been playing out in Marion recently. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Ben.
Now, this story pits Marion's mayor, Alan Buska, who I understand he's known as Snooks Buska?
That's right. Snooks is his nickname.
Snooks or Snooks?
Snooks.
Snooks Buska. And
yeah.
He's in this saga, he's pitted against a group that's calling itself Citizens for a Better Marion. What happened?
Well, the first thing that Snooks Buska's lawyers did was challenge the very notion that Citizens for a Better Marion could call themselves Citizens for a Better Marion. They argued that it was a made-up name, and then one of the lawyers for the mayor proclaimed that if they could make up a name, then their side should be called Citizens for Truth, Justice, and the American Way. And then he asked the city council to refer to him as Captain America.
Okay, what gripe do they have against the mayor?
Well, they claim, their contention is that the mayor says that he lives in Marion. He owns at least a couple of homes in Marion and claims to reside in one of them. The Citizens for a Better Marion contends that he actually doesn't live in Marion, that he lives in Hiawatha, which is a nearby town.
Mm-hmm. And they went to great extent to try to prove this in their own way. They hired a private investigator?
They did. They hired a private investigator who tracked the mayor, his comings and goings from the Hiawatha house where his wife lives. They tracked him for 12 days, including Christmas Day and Thanksgiving Day. And, I mean, to the point where they would say at 9 o'clock his car pulled in, at 10 o'clock it left, and then 2 o'clock it came back. It was very, you could hear people in the audience sort of chuckling at this, at the lengths that were gone, that they went to try to figure out where the mayor lives.
And so this went on, this entire proceeding went on for 4 hours with people actually giving testimony about Snooks Buska's comings and goings from Hiawatha, but also at his residence in Marion?
Well, actually, that was the one odd thing. The investigator did not monitor the house in Marion where the mayor says he lives. They only monitored his wife's home in Hiawatha where the citizens say that he actually lives. And so he was gone from the Hiawatha house a lot, and we don't know that then if he was in Marion or not, which was a question that the council had. Another odd thing was that they did all this surveillance to sort of show that his frequency at the Hiawatha house meant that he lived there. Then when the mayor's defense attorneys they brought some neighbors on from his Marion home that said he's there a lot, the attorney for the citizens who were challenging the mayor said, well, just because someone's there frequently, that doesn't mean they live there, which totally undermined the ideas that they tried to, get across with the surveillance in the first place. So at times it was pretty comical. I mean, the crowd was decidedly pro-mayor, and they got a kick out of a lot of stuff, and there was some gavel pounding to try to get them back in order.
Uh-huh. Now, if I'm not mistaken, what qualifies as residency? Does it matter how much time you spend in your residence or if you even sleep there?
Under the law, it really doesn't. You need to be a registered voter of the community where you're serving as mayor. You need to have a residence there, and you need to spend some time there. There's no prescription in Iowa law that says you have to sleep so many nights in the town that you're, or so many nights here, so many nights there. It doesn't matter, your residency isn't determined by which sidewalks you shovel in the wintertime. So, yeah, a lot of the evidence that was brought against the mayor didn't really have a lot of bearing, considering that the law has a fairly low threshold for residency.
And the vote on this matter ended how?
Well, the council deliberated for, I think, about 30 to 40 minutes only and came back with a 5-0 vote in favor of keeping the mayor in office.
All right. Now, this is such an odd story. By the way, has Stephen Colbert been contacted about this or The Daily Show?
I don't know. It wouldn't be a bad idea.
I have to believe, Todd, there's something deeper here, something at the heart of this. What is going on in Marion to make this group act against the mayor in this way?
Well, there's some angst in the community. I mean, Marion is a fast-growing town, And fast-growing towns, you know, there's going to be some friction between folks who are a little bit wary of the way the town's growing and the way that growth is being used as an excuse or a pretext for a lot of development. And I think Snitz Buska has been a mayor that's represented a lot of your sort of longtime residents who are wary of some of the development that's being proposed for the town, particularly redevelopment of the Central Corridor area, the Central Business District, where Buska for 20 plus years owned a Dairy Queen, and he's now sold that to his daughter. On the other side, you've got folks that are more development minded and that are pushing some of those changes, and I think that, you know, you've got friction based on the, sort of between those folks, you know, development and change versus, you know, the way Marion always has been.
Okay, thanks for this story, this political saga. Odd, a story out of Marion. Todd Dorman, you can read his 24-hour Dorman column at thegazette.com. Todd, always nice to talk with you.
Hey, thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. How many spiral arms does our galaxy, the Milky Way, have? No, it's not a trivia question for a pub quiz. The answer is actually a matter of debate among scientists. But a Wartburg College professor has contributed to a new study that hopes to resolve the debate over the shape of our Milky Way. Professor Charles Figura worked with the paper's lead author for more than 5 years, doing data analysis and some of the writing. Joining us now, Charles Figura, professor of physics and director of Wartburg College's Plaatje Observatory. Welcome.
It's very good to be here.
So tell us, what has the debate been about?
The debate is trying to figure out exactly what the shape of our galaxy is. It's a much more complicated question than I think most people realize. We can look around and see what other galaxies look like, but we're stuck in the middle of our own galaxy, and it becomes a very difficult question to address.
Okay, so we are, I guess, start off by telling us where we think we are in the galaxy. You said in the middle of the galaxy, but we're on one of the arms?
Sure. Basically, the galaxy is roughly a disc-shaped object. It's about 40 kiloparsecs, roughly, from edge to edge. A kiloparsec is about 3 1/3 light years.
Mm-hmm.
And we are about, call it roughly 1/3 of the way out from the center in the disk.
In a fairly densely populated part of the galaxy?
It's actually starting to get a little bit sparse by where we are at.
Mm-hmm.
Inside of what we call the solar circle, the orbit that the sun makes around the center of the galaxy, things start to get much more crowded.
Okay, so it's clear we are inside this thing,
mm-hmm.
the Milky Way, and so it is difficult to ascertain what its shape is. So how do we go about doing that?
Well, there's been a lot of attempts over the years. It's kind of interesting to note that one of the first real attempts was put together by Isaac Newton, who figured that every star that he could see had the same intrinsic brightness. And so if he looked at all the stars and he just counted up where the stars were and where they weren't, he could get an idea for how big the galaxy was and what its shape was. And he came up with something that was completely, completely inadequate. The problem is a lot like trying to figure out what the shape of a forest is when you are in the middle of the forest.
Mm-hmm. But haven't we been able to? Because it seems like when we say galaxy, the Milky Way, we have a certain shape, a spiral arm thing. So we're
Absolutely.
Looking outside of our galaxy to other galaxies and guessing which one we look the most like?
It's something like that. You know, most people think that a galaxy is a bunch of stars. And that's true, but there's a lot of other stuff in there as well, including gas and dust. And in fact, it's the gas and dust that probably makes up the larger part of the galaxy. Hydrogen makes up about roughly 75% of all the matter in the galaxy. That hydrogen gave off light in the radio part of the spectrum. And if you looked at that light with radio telescopes, you could actually figure out where that hydrogen was. not just where in the sky, but how far away from us it was. And so they started to trace out a map that looked that had what looked like spiral arms. And at that point, you say, well, we've got these things that look like spiral arms. We see these other things that have spiral arms. We look like that.
Okay, so the debate has been not over whether we have spiral arms. We know our Milky Way has spiral arms.
Correct.
But how many spiral arms? And how did your study fit into that debate, and what did it reveal?
It's interesting that the question about spiral arms was not exactly the focus of our debate. We're actually studying a certain type of star in our galaxy, very young, newly forming, high-mass stars. These are stars that are about 8 times as massive as our own sun. They are some of the very brightest stars. They're also very, very rare. Think of, you know, we talk about, you hear a lot of talking about the 1% or the 99% in our country economically. This is a 1% of 1%.
These are the super elite stars in our
These
galaxy.
Are the super elite. These are very, very few, but they are very, very bright. And so it turns out that many of the stars that we see in our night sky actually are some of these stars. And part of what our study involved was trying to figure out exactly where, how far away from us those stars were. And once you know their distances, then you can start to put together a map of where they are in space. And that starts to look like a map of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. So how many arms do we think our galaxy has?
We find that there are 4 principal arms of the galaxy.
Mm.
An earlier study in 2008 had looked at much smaller stars, much less massive stars, and had seen that 2 of the galaxy's 4 known arms showed a lot of these stars, and 2 of them showed much fewer of that type of lower mass star. And they had concluded that we had 2 major arms, and then the other 2 were more minor arms. They were not as strong, and they were not as significant to the big picture of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. And your study concludes otherwise.
It concludes otherwise. And one of the points we're trying to make is that it's not that the previous study was wrong, but they were looking at a different population of stars, and that does change the picture a little bit.
So we think 4 arms more or less equal in size?
We'll say 4 that should be considered as major arms. We see moderately uniform levels of high-mass star formation in all 4 of these. Part of the problem comes about that low-mass stars live a very long time. May live 10, our own star has an estimated lifetime of 10 billion years. The stars that were looked at in this previous study range from a star like ours down to much less massive stars that might live 100 billion years. So very, very long times. The stars that we're looking at have lifetimes more on the order of hundreds of millions of years, so mm-hmm. You know, 1/1000th of the lifetime.
What do we know about why a galaxy should have arms? You mentioned it's like a we should imagine as a huge disk, many, many light years across. Why not have a uniform disk? Why are there concentrations that make
That's
up arms?
That's a fabulous question. The arms are commonly compared to a traffic jam. The arms themselves, the stars and the gas and the dust that make up the arms are not permanent structures of the arms. You shouldn't think of as a person waving their arms around spinning in a circle. Rather, the gas and dust and the stars are all orbiting the center, and they clump up along these lines that we think of as arms. Material piles into the back of these arms, and when it does, it triggers new star formation, and it slowly trickles out the front of the arms. So with a traffic jam on the highway, for example, I like to, to my astronomy students, I compare this to a couple of semis or a police car, a state trooper driving down the road at 55 miles an hour, or maybe 54. You come up behind them fairly quickly, and you slow down to a stop, and you clump up. And as you realize that the trooper is driving a little bit under the speed limit, you sort of boldly but cautiously decide to pass him, trying to drive as close to the speed limit as you can. And so you sort of creep out the front. And so you have this traffic jam that's moving down the road. Cars come in very quickly to the back and then trickle slowly out the front. So it's never the same group of cars at any given time. And the spiral arms are a lot like that. Material comes up from behind fairly quickly and then slowly trickles out the front. Now, the low-mass stars that form in the arms, they can live long enough to trickle out the front and move fairly far away, perhaps, from where they originally formed. But the high-mass stars live such a short time that if you see them, they are almost certainly about the same place where they formed. And so what we see in our study is a, we think, is a much more accurate snapshot of where the stars are forming, whereas the 2008 study that we reference in our paper is looking at much less massive stars, and what the stars that they're looking at may be in arms, or they may have migrated out of the arms by the time we see them.
When was the last time you saw the Milky Way with a naked eye? It's harder and harder to see it, isn't it?
It is getting harder and harder to see. I recently traveled to visit family in St. Louis and Chicago, and I'm always amazed at how poor the night sky is in those locations. I'm always glad to get home where I can actually see the stars and see the Milky Way.
So you can see it in at Wartburg College?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Not lately. It's been kind of cloudy.
All right.
But yeah, on reasonable nights, you can see the Milky Way. It's best seen in the summer when it's higher in the sky than this time of year.
We always hear about the universe expanding, for instance, but I wonder if we know if our Milky Way, our galaxy, is doing anything, expanding, contracting, smaller, larger. What's it doing?
It is growing. The Milky Way, and frankly, most galaxies that we know of do grow over time. They grow through collisions. While stars that make up the galaxies are very, very far apart from each other compared to their size, galaxies are actually fairly close together compared to their size. So we have a couple of satellite galaxies that are orbiting us, adjacent to us. The Large and Small Magellanic Clouds are probably the best-known examples of these. But as these galaxies orbit, occasionally they get too close and they collide, and so the material that makes up those galaxies combines. And so a galaxy may grow larger in size. When we look at the images from the Hubble Space Telescope, particularly there's a couple of images that many people are aware of, the Hubble Deep Field and Ultra Deep Field, that show what galaxies looked like billions and billions of years ago, we see that the galaxies in those images are typically much smaller galaxies than the kind of galaxies that we see now. And in fact, in those images where we see galaxies at different ages ago, the oldest ones are certainly much smaller than the more recent images that we're seeing. So galaxies do build up and do increase in size as they collide with other nearby galaxies, forming larger and larger structures. In some 3 or 4 billion years, in fact, the Andromeda Galaxy, which is a similarly sized spiral galaxy to our own, and in fact is the most distant object we can see with the naked eye, that galaxy will collide with us, actually.
So you've helped advance and tell us a little bit about how the Milky Way is shaped. Is this just an intellectual curiosity, given the vastness of the universe and the galaxy? Or is there some relevance to us here, life on Earth in the 21st century?
Wow, what a fantastic question. I would love to be able to say that this is very poignant, that as we go and start to, in the next 50, 100 years, start to step out into more manned exploration of space, that this will be very, very relevant. But the truth of it is, we would have to learn something immensely, great step ahead of where we are now, engineering-wise, to make use of this practically. I think there's two benefits to this kind of research that I see, and one is, I think that we are driven by curiosity. We want to know our place in the universe, and part of that is knowing what the universe looks like. We want to know what our home looks like. You move into a house, you walk around the neighborhood to get a feel for where you are. So I think in some sense it's a lot of that. I think there's some really practical results to what we do here, though. Not in the sense of how many arms does a galaxy have, but basic astronomical research and other basic research that we conduct is driven by observation. It's driven by experiment. And so what this kind of research does, independent of what we find out, is it drives mathematical skill. It drives engineering, the engineering required to make the telescopes, to make the detectors that we need to study these things. Money put into into space exploration is not being sent into space. It's paying people to do very technical jobs for the most part, the kind of things that we look at as being very beneficial economically. So I think that the benefit of the research is sort of twofold that way.
Thank you very much for enlightening us about the shape of our Milky Way. Charles Figura, professor of physics and director of Wartburg College's Plaiti Observatory. We appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
And that winds up this News Buzz edition of River to River on Friday. Our program is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.